Hey everyone, this is Steph. We've got a lot of new listeners coming in for My First Million, so if you're new, here's what we do at The Shit You Don't Learn in School. We talk about all of the things that we think school missed teaching you that enable you to thrive as an adult. And while we don't have all the answers, we do think we're asking a lot of the right questions. Questions like, should billionaires exist? Should salaries be in the open? Or what narratives do we blindly follow? By the way, if you like any of those topics, those are episodes 37, 38, and 35. Episode 35 is actually our most popular, as we dive into the craziness of the 40-hour workweek, which has been around for over 100 years, and ponder other ideas like marriage and retirement. Okay, on to today's episode, where we talk about technology that people have feared. Spoiler alert, every innovation has come with its fair share of FUD, fear, uncertainty, and doubt. That shouldn't be surprising, because it's human nature to fear that which we don't quite understand, and we'll unpack that phenomena across everything from airplanes to teddy bears. Literally, teddy bears. But before we dive in, I wanted to share a quick story. When I was in university, I was working in a lab doing battery research. It was sponsored by 3M, and it was actually the sister lab to the lab that has the patent for most of the lithium-ion batteries that we all use. So basically, I was surrounded by people a lot smarter than I was. One day at lunch, one of the doctoral students asked a bunch of us a question. He said, "Do you think we'll get to the point where it's unethical to kill robots?" And a lot of us, myself included, responded pretty quickly saying, "No way, they're just machines." But he nudged us to think a little more critically about the question, to think past what exists today and consider what could exist in the future. He started asking questions like, why is it ethical to kill robots today? Or what is intelligence? As we discussed this for a while, I found myself coming to terms with the fact that my initial assertion was based more on impulse than critical thinking. And then he reframed the question, reminding us that human intelligence itself is just a bunch of synapses. He asked, do you think that with enough time, we could also create a machine that does the same? And of course, this question gets into some muddy waters, discussions of perhaps what it means to even be human or to have a soul, if you believe in that. But the idea is that even in 2013, this coworker of mine could see into the future. He could see possibilities that many other equally smart people completely dismissed. And I share the story not because there's a right or wrong answer, but because this really stuck with me. And ever since, I've been so much more reluctant to dismiss ambitious, perhaps even outlandish ideas, because humans have consistently accomplished what we previously have considered impossible. It's a reminder that we are just as fallible as the guy who thought it would take literally 10 million years to develop the airplane, and that things that seem millions of years away may even be around the corner. So take this as a little anecdote as we venture into the episode. And by the way, if you're new and you like this episode, make sure to go listen to a few more and click that subscribe button. You won't want to miss some of our upcoming pods, including our top finds of the year, jobs that you didn't know existed, whether school is designed for learning and the future of education, and we'll even share our hacks on how we grew this podcast. All right, that's all from me. Hope you enjoyed the episode.
Ho, 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 and welcome back to the Shit You Don't Learn in School podcast. This is Calvin Rosser, and happy holidays.
And this is Steph Smith.
And today we're going to be talking about technology that people have feared. All right, Steph, between the two of us, you're more of the thought leader as it relates to technology. And what I mean by that is I think you're much more of a futuristic thinker than I am. I'm always looking to the past for the age-old lessons, but you're always thinking about the future. And I think that's a great dynamic between us. What do you want to talk about as it relates to technology?
Yeah, so I think today I maybe am more future-looking than even a couple of years ago. And something that I've learned through working in technology is how many times I've been wrong about something, where you see a new technology and you think, oh, this is really nascent, it doesn't have all the features that someone would one day need, and there's no way this is actually going to be big. And then you wait a certain period of time, that technology accelerates, and you're just like, wow, I had no idea that this thing could capture so many minds and provide so much value. And I think it really is an attribute of futurists to be able to almost remove themselves from the current state of things and transport themselves into the future to see the potential of something. And that's actually something that I'm trying to train my brain to do more of, because I actually think I'm more naturally a pessimist. And one of the social accounts or websites that I think both of us stumbled upon is something called the Pessimist Archive. So I wanted to use this episode to go through some of that archive to share all of the different innovations that people have feared at some point or another, and then use that to maybe have a more positive outlook on technology in the future, and maybe also have just a better prediction engine for what might be to come.
All right, let's get to it.
Okay, so as I dug into this pessimist archive, there were certain things that I expected to see. In our lifetime, you see a lot of fear around things like microwaves or cell phone radiation. There's tons of things that I know my mom would often tell me to be careful of. But as I went down the rabbit hole of this archive, I think I was a little surprised to see that almost every major invention or even minor invention had a lot of fear and uncertainty around it. Just to share a couple examples that I really liked. One of them was airplanes. So there was a New York Times column, I believe it was in 1903, and it was a long column about how birds are these magical creatures that have mastered flight, and humans trying to reinvent machines to do as such is going to not only be really hard, but they literally said it would take a continuous effort of mathematicians and mechanicians for 1 million to 10 million years. And the funniest part about that was 2 months later, the Wright brothers took flight at Kitty Hawk. So that's maybe one extreme example where you can see the amount of doubt at a certain period of time was so disjointed between certain individuals and other individuals who were actually making that innovation happen.
That example reminds me probably how I feel about spaceflight right now. I guess we're sending rockets to different places, and I don't know too much about that, but it seems like there's a lot of traction there. But the idea of actually traveling through space to a different planet and somehow living or engaging in that ecosystem seems absolutely nuts to me. Like, I don't even know if I think it'll happen in my lifetime.
Exactly. One of the things I want to discuss later in this episode is maybe how we view different innovations today or future innovations to come, because there certainly are some innovations some people fear today that I'm like, oh no, this is already here. But then there are certain innovations, as you mentioned, like space tourism, where I'm like, this is just really hard for me to wrap my head around. And I have a feeling that people in the early 1900s or late 1800s thought similarly about flying in thin air, right? Like birds do it. But unless you've actually seen a human do it or a machine do it, it seems pretty far-fetched.
That reminds me of something that might be unrelated, but there's all these things as it relates to human achievement. A good example is the 4-minute mile. For a long time, we didn't know if humans could run under a 4-minute mile. And then right after the first person did it, like dozens of people did it in the next year. And it was almost just seeing it was possible, made it possible in someone's mind. And therefore, a lot more people could do it.
Exactly. And I think, by the way, there are several different types of fear that people associate with these new inventions. So I guess the one we've talked about so far is probably something along the lines of, this is just completely new. How would we ever achieve this? But then there are things that already have been developed, but people associate fear with them because they just don't know what's going to happen. So for example, trains, when people first started using them, people actually thought that the human body would melt at over 30 miles per hour, which we now know is not true. Another crazy one was apparently with anesthesia. People thought that if you couldn't hear the patient scream, you didn't know if the right thing was being operated on, which obviously today we know is not the case. And then there are things like bicycles, which today we probably view as like one of the most innocuous things that we interact with. But in 1894, again, the New York Times said that riding a bicycle, if persisted, leads to weakness of the mind, general lunacy, and homicidal mania. So they viewed bicycles as this danger to society. Men also didn't like women riding bicycles.
It's pretty hard for me to tap into the mindset of how it would lead to lunacy and things. I can see things like, oh, you don't want your kids to now have a vehicle to somehow run away from the home more easily. But I think one of the things that is interesting about the theme that we're talking about is things that seem like everyday normal stuff for us was potentially crazy or thought of as extremely dangerous for some other group of people. And I think for me, that just brings a little bit of a humility to what are the things that I believe are crazy today or that are normal today that will somehow in the future be perceived just completely differently.
Yeah. And I think one theme that I noticed as I went through this archive, where we've only scratched the surface, basically every major invention had some sort of fear around it, is that it almost seems like these new inventions will tap into certain universal human fears. Many of these were like instruments of the devil, or that they would play into people's laziness and our society would get lazy. You even see that today with a lot of technologies, a lot of people saying, you know, people are so much more lazy. They don't interact the same way as before. They don't have the same attention span as before. And maybe those things are true, but it's just interesting to look several decades or even centuries back and see that people had the same fears about very different technologies, and that they had fears about all sorts of things from like teddy bears to mirrors to reclining chairs or even jazz music.
Teddy bears?
Yeah. So this one's a little odd, but basically people thought that teddy bears were a social menace, an aider and an abettor of race, suicide, and I think a couple other things. And so there seems to be there was this big fad around teddy bears, and then there was other people denouncing this teddy bear fad at some time. It looks like in the early 1900s.
Man, people are weird. A completely different example that I actually recently stumbled across was it's in a book called The Master Switch, which is about how information empires rise and fall. It's actually quite relevant to our discussion here, where you see there's a natural cycle of innovation, large companies forming, those companies becoming centralized, and then people being upset with the centralized power and creating a new paradigm. And that often comes through innovation, and it comes from people who are outside of that ecosystem, which is, I think, all related to this topic of how innovation happens and how people perceive it. But in this case, I think the story was the phone companies, there was technology that would allow basically for answering machines, you know, I call you and you don't answer, and that kind of answering machine. And businessmen were totally averse to this because they thought things like, if I left you a message on the phone, that would totally derail like a written contract we had. So they thought it would completely dismantle the way that business was done. They also were worrying about potentially people recording, talking about obscene or ethically dubious matters. They didn't want that to happen. And basically the idea was that the answering machine would just totally disrupt business, and it was completely harmful. And so they tried to do all these things to stop it from coming into the ecosystem. And what we know today is answering machines are everywhere, but they certainly did not change business that much. And they didn't even end up being that useful.
Yeah, I think one thing that I've realized through going down this rabbit hole is the inevitable nature of innovation, meaning that even if a bunch of people are like, answering machines are going to do X or Y, and they're afraid of it, and they're like, we can't let this happen in a business, at the end of the day, if a piece of technology really does provide a lot more value than what exists prior to it, people will adopt it over time. And as we've seen with not just answering machines, but many forms of technology, once you get that initial traction, the exponential nature in terms of the way that it improves and also lowers in cost makes that cycle even more inevitable. I think that's really important to keep in mind in any era, including today, because there's going to be a lot of things that we see and we're not going to like. I think a lot of people felt that way about remote work, but I feel similarly about remote work in the sense that parts of it were inevitable. It maybe changed business in a way that people didn't love, or certain people didn't love, but the net value for most people has resulted in so many more people adopting this. And as we've talked about, I at least personally think that will continue to be true.
There are two themes that are coming to mind from generally what we're talking about here, which the first one is when it comes to any new technology or even our perception of existing things, we're extremely bad at predicting what good or bad outcomes will come from something that's new. And then the second is because of that, we could either be too confident in our ability to predict the future, or we may have these irrational fears and not dive into something. And I think that then leads us to miss a new wave of innovation that's going to change our lives or that we can take advantage of. And this is one of the big themes of this book, The Master Switch, which is these big information empires, which basically control how we think, how we communicate, et cetera. They are resistant to change. And the change that comes from outside seems innocuous at first. But then all of a sudden, once it gets that traction that you were talking about, the whole industry gets dismantled. Those companies sometimes don't survive. They go bankrupt and a new industry emerges. And it seems like it came out of nowhere, but it was hidden in plain sight. And just your resistance to seeing that or even exploring it is the reason that your company didn't survive.
I think what you said is really important because we all focus a lot more on the current state of things, both the current state of the technology, but also the current state of our lives. And it's really hard to think outside of that and think through how both of those things evolve with time. Just to give a couple examples of this. So I saw an image earlier today where some newspaper was basically shitting on the New York Times for their digital efforts. And that's because at that given point in time, did they have much traction? No. Did they have some traction? Yes. But compared to, of course, the lion's share of readership, which was with physical newspapers, it looked like a really dumb bet. Similarly, when email, electronic mail, was becoming a thing, a lot of people were saying, this is just really inefficient. Why do we need this? This doesn't make any sense as compared to the telephone or the postal service. A similar thing was when laptops were becoming a thing. Many people were citing that we just simply don't need home computers. They're way too big. Why would anyone want this big machine in their home? I guess what I'm trying to say is that as we think through these technologies, as hard as it is, we almost need to ask the question, what can this become? Instead of where is this today, or even like micro progressions, where will this be in 6 months or a year? And just acknowledge that throughout history, humans have always surprised ourselves.
I wonder how much of this is hardwired into our brain. Have you heard of temporal discounting?
I've heard you talk about it, but I don't think I could define it myself. So why don't you share what that is?
It's basically we prefer things in the present versus the future. And so we over-index or value the present. An example is you might prefer an apple today over two apples a couple of years from now. And it has many implications for the things that we do in our life. So we often don't invest enough in our health, or we don't invest enough in the markets because we can't really appreciate the compounding nature of our daily actions. And we just think, oh, it's okay that I didn't get enough sleep today, and don't realize that might increase like our propensity for getting Alzheimer's later on. We can't value that. And I think the same thing is true with innovation. So that's one piece of it. And I think the second thing, which actually reminds me of something I did today, is it's very difficult when you're seeing pretty much a prototype or something in its early stages, when it's very clunky, it's almost half broken, when you're used to engaging with things that are pretty perfected. Let's just say like an Apple laptop, like it's pretty good right now. We expect incremental improvements. And then maybe there's something that's really going to, you know, change the way that we interface with our data and the way we work. Perhaps it's something like VR. But when you do that right now, it just doesn't compare to the Apple laptop. And it's hard to judge that technology for where it will go. As you were saying, today what I was doing was I was setting up a hard wallet for my crypto, which is the craziest clunky thing. So like you deposit money in a bank, you basically can see a nice dashboard, you can get help from customer service, or your deposit is protected. All you have to do is remember your password. And even that, you can hit forget password. For this, you have a little device and you have to write down and keep track of like 24 words. And if you lose those words, you lose all of your assets. And the device itself has like two buttons. And the idea is that you are in control of your assets. You're not relying on bankers or governments or anything else. And that puts you in the driver's seat. But to be honest, I'm doing this thing and I'm like, I can't imagine having even 10% of my net worth on this like little device or in my own hands. Like, what happens if I hit my head when I'm surfing? And the reason I'm engaging with it, besides just doing good digital security in the crypto space, is I'm testing out this new tech. It's in this space that I'm personally researching. And I'm like, okay, this hard wallet thing right now is really clunky and I cannot see this being adopted as it is by hundreds of millions of people. But at the same time, I'm like, oh, there's something here to like you control your data, you control your destiny type of thing. And I don't know what those hard wallets will become or what that security will look like, or if there's some layer that makes this easier for us so it's not such a devastating consequence. But at the same time, I've learned to open my mind to these very nascent states of technology, whether it's your friend's landing page for their first website. Even I'm thinking of my own website. When I first created it, it looked horrible. It doesn't look amazing now, but if I compared what it is today versus what it was then, it's hard to imagine that even with all of my effort, I could have gotten it there. So I think you have to fight this natural human thing where we value the present, and also fight this thing where we really can't see how something is going to become. Some people are very good at that. They can see the white space. But I think most of us were like, oh, this is shit right now. And we're missing the opportunity because we're not opening our mind to what something can become.
Yeah, I think it's a really hard line to toe. And something that I've just come to terms with is that even the smartest people in the world also struggle with this. So if the smartest people get it wrong sometimes, we're definitely going to get it wrong sometimes. Just to give a quick example, Thomas Edison, who got it right many times and literally invented the future in many ways, famously said in 1913 that the talking motion picture would never replace the regular silent motion picture. I think if the smartest people get it wrong, what I'm trying to do when I see these new innovations is just check myself, check my natural reaction to dismiss something, and not necessarily go and completely buy into every new trend, but just remind myself that probably there is something here, especially if so many smart people are talking about it. One concrete example is in 2016, 2017, I started learning about crypto, as I think quite a few people did in that bubble of 2017. And instead of just throwing my money in, which I did, not a ton, but I reacted in a financial way, what I wish I did at that time was use all of that signal of people saying this is important to learn about it and to try to get immersed in that ecosystem. That's what I'm trying to do more of today. So not dismiss new trends, but use that signal to say, hey, actually, this is worth learning about. You should actually lean into it more than dismiss it and say, this is all just hype.
Yeah, I think within that as well, at least a takeaway for me is because we're so bad at forecasting and because even the smartest people miss things or they're wrong so many times, one, don't fault people for being wrong. Actually respect people for being open-minded and taking bets and putting their opinions out there, even if they're wrong sometimes. On a similar note, though, even if someone is really smart, so let's just talk about Balaji. If you don't know who that is, he's a thought leader in the crypto space. And a lot of people treat this guy like he's some sort of god or a prophet who's, you know, showing us the future. And he's certainly been right on a number of things and is one of the most interdisciplinary thinkers that I know of, at least from listening to him. But at the same time, I think it's easy to fall in the trap of being like, oh, this guy's been right before. He's probably right about the future. Or he's so smart, he gets something that I don't. Pieces of that may be true, but don't hold his opinion as gospel in ways that then lead you to maybe take detrimental action. So I'm always cautious of experts or forecasters. There's so much good research that most forecasters or experts are just so wrong. And this is why we have something like, you know, the scientific method where people just try things over and over and maybe 99 fail and one gets closer to the truth. But then 50 years later, even that thing is debunked and we get even closer to the truth. So that would be another takeaway for me, which is don't dismiss things, but also don't just jump on the bandwagon. I think Web3 is a good example of this, where people are like, oh, this is the future. And they then get caught in this memetic hype train where they start to think in binary ways, which is this has to be the future. We're destroying what exists before. And I think pieces of that can be true while also maintaining some respect for what existed before and also things outside of that space.
Totally agreed. And I've done that before as well. I've been both on the super pessimistic side and I've also been on the hype train side. And what I'm trying to do as much as possible is to be in neither of those, which again means that when I see something new and exciting, my reaction is, let me learn more about this. Let me form my own opinions. Let me do my own research. And you've actually done this a lot with Web3, for example. That's something that I want to do more of next year. But you've taken the last, 3 months or so to just to go down the rabbit hole and learn about it. And I think that's so great because at the end of the day, I think I'm a little bit of a pessimist at heart or a bear at heart. I still think we are in this Web3 hype train. It is the future, but I think the hype has maybe inflated expectations too quickly. But the point is that regardless of whether I'm right about that or not, you are set up so that if this is the future, you can capitalize on it. You can participate in that future instead of 10 years from now wondering how you can keep up.
I think a good example for me is NFTs, which kind of took off this year. I guess the tech has existed for a while. But honestly, for the first few months where I heard about people selling images on the internet for very large prices, I'm like, this is dumb. This is just a bubble. And at least as I've dove deeper into the different aspects of the crypto space, I've even found myself buying some of these images, which maybe I'll later regret. But the point is, in diving in and actually learning about some of the things that people are excited about, I still have this sense of a lot of this stuff isn't going to work. A lot of people are going to lose money in different ways, and they're probably going to regret their decisions and aren't thinking super clearly. But at the same time, I'm like, oh, there is something here. And actually, I think the something here is something that will be a lot clearer in the next 5 years when new applications and new tests that people run work out. And we see these new ways of integrating, you know, their somewhat new technology into our existing business practices. And that's made me, I'd say, more open-minded or excited about just what people are doing. And I'm trying not to jump in the financial hype train of it, but at the same time, kind of passively observing and being like, oh, this is cool, and watching what people are doing there. And I think that's one way to do it. But it took me overcoming this initial reaction of, this is dumb.
Yeah. And I think a distinction in addition to this is dumb is to catch yourself if you are specifically trying to protect something today. So for example, when it came to ATMs, ATMs came and basically displaced the job of counting money for many bank tellers. And everyone thought, we can't do this because this is what bank tellers do. Well, what ended up happening is actually, I think banks hired more bank tellers over time. They just did different work. Similarly, many people were against cross-country railroads because they thought they would completely disrupt the local industries. They probably did to an extent, but they probably also brought a lot of new jobs. Remote work is one final thing that I'll say, which is that again, I think people just need to be aware of when they're against something because it has no value or because they're afraid of what it's disrupting in their current state. So remote work, I think a lot of people were protecting this idea of how they've worked for so long, which is going into the office, being around your coworkers, seeing how much people are working. And so I don't know if that made sense, but I think it's important to add that layer of reflection. Am I trying to protect something or does this thing really just not have any value?
Something that was interesting about remote work, we were pretty early in that, which is something I think we know more acutely now. But a lot of my friends, when they saw me traveling around, working remotely or whatever, they're thinking, oh, that seems nice, but I would have to make this big trade-off in terms of my career progression. And at least in our case, I think that proved to not be true. But what actually made it even less true was COVID accelerated the development of remote work. So more companies transitioned to it, which meant more opportunities. And it meant the trade-off for your career is actually less. And so by being early and taking a bet on that and finding a way to navigate your own path, you had some sort of advantage against people who dismissed it. But those people were not necessarily wrong. They just maybe didn't see what was coming. And I don't think we saw what was coming either. And now there's actually less of a trade-off there. So the present state of remote work as it relates to your career acceleration is very different than it was 5 years ago.
Yeah, and I actually think it was reasonable to doubt remote work, let's say 5 years ago, certainly 10 years ago, the same way that it's reasonable to doubt any innovation that hasn't truly embraced the masses. But I'd say today, there are still quite a few people who I think now fit into that category of protecting what used to be, meaning that, as you said, more data has come in, the trade-offs are less significant, but people still seem to be wanting to go back to what they had before.
100%. And actually, there's a quote from a book that I love, which I think is probably the most dense wisdom per word of any book. It's called The Lessons of History by the Durants, who have written lots of history books, but they condensed all of history into 100 pages. Very good read. But it's the following. It is good that the old should resist the young and that the young should prod the old. Out of this tension, as out of the strife of the sexes and the classes, comes a creative tensile strength, a stimulated development, a secret and basic unity and movement of the whole. And I think what that's getting at is there actually is this kind of beautiful tension within society of people with different beliefs, of people from different backgrounds, or it's pretty prevalent amongst the old and the young. Hey, we used to do it this way and it was so much better. Remember the good times? And people are talking about the good times, which were actually, in terms of quality of life, much worse times. And maybe there were certain things like you had more in-person interaction, but you certainly weren't able to FaceTime your grandson who lived in a completely different state across the country. And so there's like all of these benefits that have come from the modern era. Yet if you talk to the old, they're always like, remember the good old days? And the old versus young is one good way to think about that quote. But I think it's true of all of these things, which is work is changing. The way that we view people from different backgrounds is changing. Society is constantly moving. But all of this tension that is created that, you know, manifests in Twitter arguments and deep conversations with your friends or whatever, it all leads us in a slow little direction, which could be called progress or innovation. And at the end of it, hopefully we're all a little bit better off. And that's something I personally believe. I find that to be a very healthy tension. And I think it's awesome when people disagree with me and I have the chance to really rethink my beliefs or at least try to communicate them to someone else, knowing that I may be completely wrong or that I may end up on the right end of whatever it is that we're talking about.
Yeah. And I think one important part of that tension is that if people are listening, they probably think that we err more on the side of innovation is great and we should embrace all new innovations. But I want to clarify the importance of that older generation that you mentioned as well, that keeps that younger generation in check. And I think sometimes that younger generation will get upset or they'll say things like, you just don't understand the future, or okay, boomer, or whatever it is. But I think it's important to have, as that quote said, both sides of that equation, because as exciting and as innovative as the young generation is, even though it doesn't seem like it sometimes, they do benefit from the tug and pull of the perhaps more conservative generation.
100%. As it relates to innovation, personally, I would say I'm a catastrophizer. So I see all the things that would go wrong. I wouldn't say I'm particularly forward thinking on anything in particular, but have learned to at least open my mind to the possibility that both one, I can be wrong, two, different ideas may actually end up yielding better outcomes than what I think is the best solution, and three, that it's all of us coming together in this weird collective mess that we call society, debating different things and leveraging the wisdom of the past with the optimism, perhaps of younger generations, that leads us in a cool direction.
Okay, so far we've talked a lot about the past, all of the innovations that were feared at some point and in some way, shape, or form have been proven wrong. Of course, we didn't talk about all of the innovations that didn't come to be that the pessimists were right about, but I want to talk about today. As you mentioned, we are constantly evolving. There are going to be new innovations in the next 2 years, the next 20 years, the next 200 years that truly we can't predict, but we're going to try to anyway. So what are some of the technologies that you see in their nascency today that are being doubted or that there's a lot of pushback on that you think maybe in, let's say, 50 years, we'll look back on in the same way that we're looking back on some of those headlines from the early 1900s?
So I think one idea that comes to mind, it's maybe not something that we're fearing, but it's something that we're underestimating. And I truly believe that with all of the new tech in terms of tracking, whether it's tracking of your glucose levels, of sleep, et cetera, or ability to sequence genomes at a really low cost and a faster rate, or ability to develop new therapeutics or vaccines or whatever due to novel technologies. I think people are underestimating the changes that we'll see in medicine and genomics. And basically what that will lead to is, yes, we're going to probably have things like designer babies, and there's going to be a massive societal pushback against that because it's obviously going to privilege the people with access to those technologies, which is likely the rich. We're going to see things like, hey, you have shoulder pain or you have some disease. Maybe we can actually not have you just try to cope with that pain, but we can solve that problem and solve many of those types of problems where people are no longer living in chronic pain, or people can, you know, have their vision restored or something that just dramatically improves your quality of life. Also, I think a personal issue for me is with mental health. My mom died of suicide, which we dove into in our last episode. And I think just our ability to understand what it is that drives good mental health outcomes for people and how we can combine someone's unique, say, outlook, experiences, and biology and move them in a direction where they just have an overall better quality of life as it relates to their mental health, I think we're going to get much better at that. So you see lots of research in things like psychedelics, which have a lot of promises, but probably have a lot of downsides as well. I think you're seeing a lot of investment there because there's the potential to do something that we haven't been able to do. It seems that pumping pharmacological solutions into people isn't the only answer to, say, making sure that people live a high quality of life or reducing suicides or whatever the goal is. So I'll stop there. But broadly speaking, I think we're really underestimating the changes that we'll see even in the next 10, 20 years as it relates to our overall well-being and health and ability to solve problems that maybe people have assumed are just a part of life. I guess you could throw aging in that as well.
Yeah, I have to say that the pessimist in me, when I first heard of longevity or longevity science, I really was like, what the hell is this? We have so many problems on Earth already. Why would we go and try to make everyone live forever? That's just going to multiply the problems that we already have. But I've come around to that. I'm not necessarily for longevity, but I think you're right. That area of science is going to develop in ways that today we can't really imagine. And I think it's going to happen more quickly than we think. And you hear different scientists in that space say that there really is like a tipping point. We haven't reached it yet, but once you reach that tipping point, people go from living 80 years to something like infinite. It's strange because you would think it would go from like 80 to 100 to 120, but it doesn't seem to be the case. And I think you're right that we'll see similar tipping points with other biotech innovations. You even see it today with like mRNA. They're now looking at using that for cancer treatment. Seems like with biology, which isn't so different to software, there are these exponential gains or these really important tipping points. And once you get past them, you're just like, wow, I could have never pictured this.
And in the longevity space, I would say I fell into the same trap. And there's this classic trope of, oh, rich billionaire wants to live forever. And you're like, come on, dude, we're just all going to die. And why don't you just chill out and enjoy your life? Like you earned all this money or whatever. And I'd say I've personally had a change of heart as it relates to this, as I've thought about my own life. And it's not that I want to live forever, but I want to live, you know, pain-free or with limited pain and have a longer health span. And there's basic things like tracking my sleep and figuring out what foods spike my glucose and really just thinking about some of those things. And they're becoming more accessible to the everyday consumer. And that's just like the basic stuff that's available to us now. I think it's easy to write off those, which I did for many years like you. And in my head, I'm like, oh, it's not just rich tech billionaires. This is something that can kind of change the human condition in a way that leads to, say, more joy or happy moments for more people. And I think that's net good. What about you?
Well, I just wanted to comment on what you just said there, because I do think that in the past, I approached some of these ideas with more of zero-sum thinking instead of positive-sum thinking, in the sense that, yes, it's really easy to be like, why are we going to space? To be like, oh, space tourism, this is just a bunch of billionaires having a midlife crisis. And maybe there's some truth to that, but ultimately, every innovation starts off with a small, likely wealthy group of people. And then again, it gets cheaper over time, it gets better over time, and then it's distributed to the masses. Cell phones are the perfect example of that, where I'm sure, I don't have any quotes prepared, but I am sure that in the early days of the cell phone, people thought, oh, this is just a tool for rich people. And now we can see that billions of people around the world have cell phones. So to get back to your question, I don't know if there's anything that people are really pushing back against today that I'm like, wow, they don't see the future. Maybe one thing that I know I've talked about a lot is the future of work. I think there's significant elements to it that I think people will be surprised by how quickly they come. One of those aspects is the globalized nature of it. The same way that we saw the globalization of things like manufacturing, I think we're now going to see just a rapid shift to the globalization of at least the digital workforce. And there's going to be a lot of pushback for that, because a lot of people are going to say, we can't have jobs stolen from our citizens. We can't have XYZ abroad. But I think that's going to be one of those things that is just going to be really hard to stop. So that's one area. We've talked about it a little bit, but there are certain areas where I have to candidly say, I don't know if I fall in the pessimist bucket, but it is really hard for me to wrap my head around the idea that people could be living on Mars in our lifetime. The futurist in me wants to believe that's possible, but there is a part of me that's just like, man, that just seems really far-fetched and seems like something we will eventually do, but I don't know how to think about that timeline.
Yeah, that brings up kind of an interesting point, which is I think it's really healthy to develop a more open mind to what the future can be and to make sure that you're a part of it, but you don't have to be on the cutting edge of everything. And as it relates to living on Mars, I fall in the same camp of it seems both too far away and too intangible for me to really focus on. So I'm not going to discount it, but at the same time, I'm not going to focus on it. Whereas there are other things which I would say maybe I fear or that I think are a little bit on the bleeding edge of ideas, but that are still possible and maybe even likely. And so just two examples of that. One would be, I went to like a very good US university. And in the US, you basically have this system where, you know, a very small number of people go to these elite universities, and they're often people from privileged backgrounds. And those people end up having outsized influence in society, disproportionate opportunities, et cetera. 5 years ago, it would have been very hard to convince me that the Princeton Harvards of the world would somehow be dismantled by some new form of education or new way of being. And I'd say at this point, I still don't know that those institutions will completely go away, but I am more open-minded to ideas, things like instead of your Princeton or Harvard or Yale degree, what you have is a series of tasks or jobs that you've completed, and those are codified and verified. People talk about using the blockchain for this. Your intelligence, or say like social proof, isn't your degree that you spent 4 years getting, which really was just like a stamp versus say like specific skills you learned. And instead, it's these like series of verifications where truly a meritocratic system wins, where if you are the smartest or the hardest working or whatever, you have that verified. And so companies, instead of going through the interview process that they do now or recruiting at specific schools, will look to things like that, which don't require you to go to those schools. And that may be cheaper and more accessible to people around the world. And so that goes along with your theme of like globalization of the talent workforce. Another idea is, and I'm trying to wrestle with this right now, I feel like so many of the things that I do and paid well to do will be automated by technology. And I think what that means is we may move to more of a gig worker world where we have to work less, or we have more choice in our work. And it's more like fractionalized work where we do something for one company and something for another company. And a lot of it is more like creative knowledge work versus, say, things that can either be outsourced to much cheaper locations, which has already happened and continues to happen, or robots or AI or whatever takes that over. I think practically what that means is just, you know, we're not going to log in 9 to 5, or many of us won't, and earn a living. We're going to do that in different ways. And maybe those ways will unlock like new ways of us being creative or tapping into things that we enjoy or our unique skill sets, and that work will look very differently. And so instead of trying to predict that necessarily, one of the things I'm doing is I'm just trying to dive into new fields, whether it's, say, the crypto Web3 space, or this idea I was talking about, like new ways of educating children, or new ways in which education may shape the way in which we hire people, and just saying, hey, I want to learn more about this so that me, when I'm 40 or 50 or whatever, is not completely left behind. And at least I've started thinking about these things and can pay attention to what's happening.
I think your approach there makes sense. And I've been doing something similar, which basically means I'm trying to learn skills in many different places so that regardless of the way the future unfolds, I will probably be okay. And I think the main way that you can really get left behind in a way where you're in a pretty terrible spot is trying to maintain what is currently true today against forces that are inevitably trying to change it. So it's, again, people being like, oh, robots can't steal our jobs, instead of actually going and learning a job that wouldn't be offset by a robot, or learning to program robots. They are lobbying for governments to stop this, or they are just complaining on Twitter and saying, this can't happen. Maybe those are bad examples, but the idea is that instead of trying to resist a wave, and you may not know exactly which way that wave will break, just embracing the wave, surfing that wave, and setting yourself up so that you can do that.
Yeah, one thing that just came to mind that kind of blew my mind as we were talking is, 5 years ago, if you had asked me, like, how can I earn an income? I would have been like, oh, I can just go get a job at a company and they will pay me a salary. And now I'm looking at my life. I'm not a W-2 employee. Like, I don't work for one company, and I probably have 6 to 8 income streams. Some of them are very low income streams. But at the same time, like, there's all these ways of making money, and I'm doing it from all these different sources. So if one goes down, then maybe I can scale another up, or maybe I can figure something else out. And I probably would have never been able to tell you that, oh, I was going to be able to not work for a company, still make some income to pay the bills, and it would come from all these different sources of work, which I would not have thought of as work. And that to me just reflects like how wrong my past self would have been, and probably how wrong my current self is for what will be.
Yeah, that reminds me of the Elon Musk tweet from the other day, which said, given the almost unimaginable nature of the present, what will the future be? And it's like a clip of Bill Gates basically being made fun of on a talk show in 1995 as he talks about the internet. And that is what, 25 years ago? And even as you said, within our lifetime in the last 5 years, you've seen how much has changed. So it's crazy to think what the hell is going to be true in the next 25 years or the next 50 years or the next 100 years. It's just totally unimaginable.
It also just happened so fast. Think about this year, for example, in financial markets, you saw a situation where literally retail traders who previously always held the bag for institutional investors who had a lot of capital, they were able to literally move markets. So like GameStop, Dogecoin, et cetera. Now, did everyone make money on this? No, but you had a situation where things like Robinhood and other applications and say even social media or Reddit channels or whatever, all of those technological forces came together such that retail traders were actually able to, in some ways, make institutional investors lose money, which was completely flipping the script. And I bet if you talk to institutional investors about this year, they would be like, what the hell just happened? I didn't think that could even happen.
Yeah, that's what's so crazy about technology is that it's exponential in nature. And then you layer on other forms of technology, which are also exponential. And then you get crazy phenomena like that, where people thought something would come in 30 years and really it came in 3 or something like that, even if the first year seemed really slow.
So how do you want to wrap this up?
I guess my takeaways are that if people haven't gone down this rabbit hole of looking up past inventions and seeing how people reacted to them at the time, I think it's a really great exercise because it reminds you of some of the things we've discussed. It reminds you that it's really hard to predict the future. It reminds you that even some of the smartest people throughout time have gotten it wrong. It reminds you that innovation is constant and it's impossible to stop. So I think it sets the foundation for you to maybe come out of it and reflect and maybe have a new outlook on the technology of the future or how you're interpreting the technology of today. How about you? What are your key takeaways?
I think there are a few. The first one is just that there's nothing new about technology being feared. Probably the most common thing people have heard is robots are going to take my job. But there's all kinds of ways in which that general sentiment just flows into the way that we think about the world. It's not new. It's going to stick around. It's a part of human nature. And I would just say, find ways, if you can, for areas where you may be interested or may benefit from, to just keep a slightly open mind or to learn to check your impulse. And it may take you a month or two after hearing something to do that, but don't just write something off or go with the common narratives, which might be my second point. I think fears and hopes, so optimism, they're both mimetic. And so let's just go to Web3 again, which is there's one group being like, this is the future. This is an improvement to so many different things. You'll see, we're still early. And then there's this other group, which is just a small group of privileged people are getting rich from this thing. It's not actually useful. Whatever. There's basically a negative side to that. And I think what you believe is probably largely related to what media you consume or the people that you hang out with. And it's probably not like a first principles view of, oh, I went and played around with this thing, or I really thought about the benefits of decentralization versus centralization, or all the things that you would need to have some sort of informed opinion here. And maybe that's not interesting to you, but there are other examples probably in your life of things that it's easy to just go with the common narrative, whether it's a good or bad sentiment. And it may just be more useful to develop your own lens on that and learn to think for yourself instead of going with the winds. Because I think if you are early to something that you are genuinely interested in, that's where people get the most outsized gains as it relates to their financial condition or their happiness in life. Probably the third thing, which we talked about earlier in the episode, is just there's this natural tension between the old and the young, the centralized and the decentralized innovations and incumbent technologies. And this is just not going to go away because this is the process of like how the world moves forward or at least changes. And you may not like those changes. And I think that's okay in certain cases, fight for what you care for. But at the same time, don't be upset that exists, that other people just don't see it your way or something. Like try to learn from those people who see things differently. You may not come to their side, but you may come out a more balanced thinker or someone who can find ways to make these changes work for you instead of the old salty pessimist who is always like, the stock market's going to decline, the stock market's going to decline. And when it declines 5%, they're like, see, I told you. But then you look over time and the whole thing just keeps going up and you missed out on all the gains along the way while also being the salty person that no one really wants to hear from. And I would say default to optimism if you can. I'm not naturally that way, but I try to force myself to be that way because it's both probably more inspiring, but it also, I think, is just a better disposition to, you know, bring to the world.
Yeah, I think that's a great perspective to have. I mentioned this before, but I do want to reiterate the importance of both the old guard and new guard. The people who are really driving innovation, we need them. We need their creativity. We need them to see the future that many of us can't picture. But at the same time, we do need a little bit of the old guard to keep things in check. If there are new technologies and there's absolutely no standards, no regulations, you're also going to end up with bad outcomes. And so both are necessary. And it's actually pretty amazing that humans have been able to create a system that does naturally advance forward over time, but has some of these checks and balances at the same time. So if you're on either side of that coin, I think it's important to appreciate the other side and not approach it from the perspective of just saying they just don't get it or just completely dismissing them.
I think two quick examples of what you're talking about. The first would be, say, in crypto or Web3, the industry can certainly benefit from some regulation. There's lots of what I would call sketchy behavior that may be detrimental to certain people. And so you could argue, oh, people choose to be involved and they're adults and they can make their own decisions. But at the same time, the industry is heavily not regulated because the people who developed it found a way outside of the existing regulations. And I think that industry in particular, whether you see it as good or bad, can benefit from regulation, which would be, say, the old guard being like, oh, you know what? We have limitations on stock trading or angel investing, et cetera, for a reason. And those didn't just come out of some stodgy people who were like, the world needs to be this way. They probably came out of some crises or other things. So I think another thing is, let's say you're very innovative. It's very easy to look at what's wrong with what exists right now without considering the historical context in which that was developed. And this is probably true for policies as well. You're like, wow, this is a really regressive policy. Well, at the time, it might have been very progressive or very useful. Maybe it's become outdated, or maybe it exists for a reason that you're not really thinking about. The second would be an idea that I want to talk about in our next pod, which will be around making sure that you maintain a high degree of mental liquidity, which would be your ability to change your mind on certain topics. And so maybe a controversial one for you to noodle on, depending on your beliefs, is the pandemic. I think a lot of people and their beliefs about the pandemic and all the things that we should do and what it means for society, a lot of those beliefs come from what you learned or who you surrounded yourself in the first 2 months of the pandemic. And I think a lot of people are anchored on whatever it was that their experience was or their peer group, et cetera. And I haven't seen as much, I'd say, mental liquidity, which would be updating our beliefs based on the data that's coming in, instead of people becoming more and more entrenched on their side for something that is a complex public health issue. Let's dive into that more in the next pod. But I think this idea of mental liquidity and learning how to be able to change your mind and take in new data is rarely practiced, but also very useful towards what we're talking about.
I thought we could actually end it with a clip from an 1865 newspaper.
How fun.
It says, "Well-informed people know that it is impossible to transmit voice over wires, and that were it possible to do so, the thing would be of no practical value." And here we are, 150 years later, transmitting voice over wire, hopefully providing value to people listening. So that's just one example of how we truly cannot even predict what might be to come.
And the other truth is that whoever wrote that piece is now in the grave and doesn't care about our podcast. So life is short, live it, and until next time.
Thanks for listening. And don't forget, if you like this episode, click that subscribe button so you don't miss the rest.